It was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest. Don read from the NIV, and it says that it's something that we need, fulfills our need. The Holman Christian Standard Bible says, "For this is the kind of high priest that we need." It's the kind of high priest that is fitting that we should have. And that phrase fitting, which is an appropriate translation, but somehow it makes it sound, at least to me, like the kind of high priest that we are getting is what we earned. Because we did so much, and now we're getting this high priest that is fitting for us. He's suitable for us because we're this kind of person. And I don't want us to get that impression from this. And so I want to stick with that idea of need. The point here isn't that we've done something to earn this high priest and now we've got the high priest we deserve. He's fitting for us. The phrase actually speaks of something that we need. What is it that we need, and why do we have this need? We have a need that only Christ fulfills. And I want to start off at the beginning by saying, what is that need and where does it come from? 17th century New England Primer. Has anybody ever read the New England Primer? You know how today Debbie did. You know how today when we teach the alphabet, a lot of times it's A is for apple, B is for ball, or something along those lines. The New England Primer was a book that was supposed to teach reading to little children, but it was published by Puritans, and it kind of became the standard. Here are some of the things that they did when they talked about the letter D. When they were teaching the letter D, instead of just saying D is for dog, they said D, the dog will bite the thief at night. So you have the word dog in there. D, the dog will bite the thief at night. E, the eagle's flight is out of sight. F, might like this one. The idle fool is whipped at school, which apparently is something that the Puritans did. Some of them are much more biblical and theological. P is Peter denies his Lord and cries. Q, Queen Esther comes in state to save the Jews from a dismal fate. Some of them you wouldn't even think. That's P and Q. Those are very well-known stories. How about U? Uriah's lovely wife made David seek his life. No joke, that's what it was. And then one that you would expect to see in a children's primer for Z, Zacchaeus did climb the tree his Lord to see. But it all starts with A. And A is profound. A is foundational. A, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. What does it mean, in Adam's fall, we sinned all? What does it mean that Adam fell, or that we as humans fell in Adam? There's certain things that are changed in Adam, certain things that are different in Adam. The Jews have the concept of the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is called, it's the word Yetzer is inclination, and Hara is one of the words for evil. It's the evil inclination. One of the things that happened in the fall is that we received an evil inclination. Paul addresses that evil inclination in Romans 3:9. He says, "For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under the power of sin." That's the Yetzer Hara. We're all under the power of sin. Because of that, not only are we cursed with an evil inclination, it's not just that we're under the power of sin, but the fact is that we act on that inclination, don't we? We act on that inclination. Also in Romans 3, Romans 3 goes on to say in verse 9, "For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under the power of sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one." No one understands. No one seeks God. No one. We act upon that evil inclination. It's not just that we're inclined to evil, but we kind of muster it up inside of us to do what's right most of the time. Because of Adam's fall, because of that sin, we have this evil inclination, and boy, are we quick to act on it. All because of Adam. Here's an illustration. Have you ever picked up a history book? Some of you I know love history. You love history. But let's face it. History, unless you have somebody writing with an agenda, history is not usually the story of triumph. History is basically the story of humanity's swinging from one fall to the next. We go from one war to another war. And even in the last century, when we had, this has got to be it. This has got to be the war to end all wars. We're sure of it. Never even fully recovered from that war before we had another war to end all wars. We just can't stop. You pick up a history book and it's an endless stream of tragedy, and for the most part it's the working out of the very thing that happened through Adam. It's that evil inclination. Men, even trying to do right, do evil. By the way, I'm saying men generically, women. We find ourselves then with an evil inclination, always willing to act on that inclination. And what does that do? It renders us morally, ceremonially, completely impure. So, well, that's who we are. Kahu, thank you for that wonderfully depressing description of the state of humanity. It's right, though, isn't it? I mean, observationally, it's right. Biblically, it's right. Why is this a problem? It's a problem because Habakkuk 1:13 says to God, "God, you are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look on wrong." God is so pure that he cannot tolerate evil. He cannot tolerate sin. And folks, that means he cannot tolerate us. That's the problem. What we have become, when it says in Adam's fall, we sinned all, what we have become in Adam is repulsive to God. God is repulsed by us. Now here's the problem. This is a rhetorical question. Don't answer out loud. Do you feel repulsive? I mean, do you sit down at home just you know, oh, I'm so repulsive. I'm so morally compromised. I have this evil inclination. I'm such a horror. I'm so bad before. No, we don't usually sit down and do that. We don't usually sit down and become so repulsed with the nature of our character or the character of our nature. When we look at ourselves, it's kind of like, just me. When I think about who I am, I'm just me. I'm not really good or bad. I'm just kind of a guy. In fact, this is most clearly seen when you think, I'm not so bad. And then you see somebody else doing or saying the exact same thing that you would do or say. And you're like, what a horrible person. But when it comes to me, I'm not that bad. I mean, I'm not that good. I'm not that bad. I'm just kind of in the middle. I'm like the majority of people in the world. I'm just in the middle. History tells the story. History tells us, no, you're not just neutral. We're not just okay people, just kind of floating around, neither good nor bad. History tells the story that we are bad people. We come from bad stock. We don't come from a people who are morally superior to any other people. We are just as bad as the person next to us. But we don't sense it, do we? I'm not supposed to use personal illustrations too close to home, but I'm going to do it anyway. Karen and I have been married for a long time now. There was something we discovered early on, that in her family, it's mostly her family, that in her family, if somebody does something wrong, it's kind of excusable if in doing wrong, it's cute. In my family, and I didn't discover this until much, much more recently, because I heard stuff, I was like, you know what the problem with your family is? Then years later, it was pointed out to me that our family has a similar flaw. That if someone does something wrong, it's almost excusable. In fact, sometimes it is excusable if it's funny. And the reason for that is because people in her family tend to be cute. People in my family tend to be funny. And so when it comes to moral failure of any kind, where we sin against God, it's like, well, yeah, that was bad, but it's kind of funny. Or that was bad, but oh, it was so cute. Why? It's because that's the way we are with ourselves, right? The way I do things is kind of right. The way everybody else does stuff is kind of suspect. What I like is good. What other people like, you know, I don't even understand how someone could like that. Well, how do you get over that barrier? How do you get over humanity's evil inclination, yes, but also humanity's inclination to excuse the evil inclination? And to sidestep it and to overlook it and to say, well, it's just okay. This is what God did. To one family across the face of the earth, God gave the law. And the law was this meticulously clear expression of the character and nature of God. What God says is right, what God loves, and what God hates. He reveals that to the family of Israel, the family of Jacob. The law is a series of do's and don'ts that clearly reflect the character of God. And then what he does, thankfully for us, is he records how that family responds to the law. Romans 15 tells us that those things were written for our learning. We look at how Israel responds to the law, and it reflects how we respond to the law. How do we respond to God's character? In the process of this, he appoints priests in that law. The priesthood is central. It's central and it's crucial, but it's not central and crucial to making that family any better than our families. And you read Israel's history, and it's easy to see. They're not better than anybody. There is no moral superiority in them. They're just as messed up as the rest of us. That priesthood is not central and crucial for them being perfect. That priesthood is central and crucial to helping Israel and all who observe Israel to understand that whether we feel repulsive or not, in God's eyes, we, as Romans 3 puts it, have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That priesthood was central to that. He gave visceral reminders of the horrific nature of sin. The sin that we shrug at, the sin that we think is cute, the sin that we think is funny. He said, that's going to cost this dove its life. That's going to cost this lamb its life. That's going to cost this bull its life. And you literally had to go down and take an animal and bleed it to death as it cried out. And your senses were engaged. And you realize that the wages of sin was death. You remember how in Adam we acquired the Yetzer Hara, that evil inclination, and the subsequent types of defilements. Each one of those priests, just like us, is cursed with the same evil inclination as every other human being. And the problem with that is that they are, because of that, disqualified from making us right with God. They can't fix any of it. They can't fix our evil inclination because they've got one too. They can't make it right. For a priest to make it right and to rectify all of this, he himself would need to be untouched by our evil inclination. He himself would have to be morally pure. He himself would have to be ceremonially clean. He would have to be all of this so that he could deal with our sin, not just here, not just sin as we commit it, but he would have to deal with, he would have to be this pure in all these areas of his life so that he could deal with our sin, not just here, but in the realm of heaven, in the very presence of God. He would have to be all these things. And folks, please understand, that level of purity, because the evil inclination is so tied to who we are as human beings, that kind of thing is virtually, in fact, I don't even want to say virtually, that kind of thing is impossible. But we need it. It's impossible, but we need it. And that's where we come to Hebrews 7:26. Hebrews 7:26 says it was fitting. I mentioned the Holman Christian Bible says this is the kind of high priest we what? Need. We need him. The fact of the matter is, many times in life, we don't get what we need. But God gave us what we need. Look at the description of Jesus. It says that he is holy. He is innocent. He is unstained. This is all in verse 26. He's separated from sinners and he's exalted above the heavens. This is the kind of high priest we were given in Christ. This is the kind of high priest that we need. We cannot have any other kind of high priest. We need Christ. I'm going to see three things then in these three verses that describe Jesus and his office as the high priest. The first thing is that Jesus fits. I get that fits from the word in verse 26 in most of your translations when it says that it was fitting. For it was indeed fitting that we should have a high priest. What does it mean that he was fitting? Well, it says that he is that fitness or the needfulness that he has. It says, first of all, that he is holy. The word holy here means that he is free from that evil inclination. He's free from it. Remember what we said in Adam's fall, we sinned all? Jesus doesn't have that evil inclination. And remember, we said that our evil inclination leads us to act on that evil inclination. And acting on that evil inclination renders us morally guilty. We sin. We sin in thought, we sin in deed, we sin in word. Yet the passage says here, after it declares Jesus to be free from that inclination to evil, it then says that he is innocent. Since he doesn't have the inclination to evil, he is innocent. He doesn't act on an inclination he doesn't have. He's innocent. He's free from moral guilt. The third thing it says is that he is unstained. This talks about freedom from ceremonial impurity. He's free from the evil inclination. He's free from moral guilt. He's free from ceremonial impurity. What does that then, what does that allow him to do that no other priest could ever do? If Jesus is untouched by our sin, if he is untouched because he himself is morally, ceremonially pure and doesn't have a will, doesn't have that evil inclination, he's holy. What does that leave for him? It says then, also in verse 26, that he is separated from sinners. Some people say that separated from sinners is another depiction of his moral purity, but I don't think that's what it's saying. I think this is talking about his literal separation from sinners, that he didn't just die and stay in the grave. He rose from the dead and then he ascended, and that put a barrier between him and sinners. Why is that important? That's important because he is morally free from sin, which allows him to ascend, as the verse continues and says, higher than the heavens, exalted above the heavens. And what does he do in the heavens? He represents us to the Father. He's exalted above the heavens means that he accesses the very presence of the Father, the very presence of God. Jesus is the high priest that we need. And so the first thing we see in verse 26 is that Jesus fits. He fits. He's holy. He's innocent. He is unstained. He's separated from sinners so that he can access the highest heavens, the very presence of God. And folks, we need that. The second thing we find out about Jesus here is that Jesus not only fits, but Jesus fulfilled. Jesus fulfilled. What I mean by this is that he did what had to be done. Look at verse 27. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily. Why doesn't he need to offer sacrifices daily? Because he doesn't have sin. So he doesn't need to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people. Listen to this. Since he did this once for all. The idea here is that if you have to do it daily, the priest has to do it daily. He has to do it daily because the next day he's defiled. Jesus does it once and never has to do it again because he did it once for all time. He did what needed to be done. He fulfilled what needed to be done. The sacrifice of Jesus happened once for all time, never to be repeated. Have you ever been to a church where they give an altar call? I grew up in the context of a church that gave an altar call, and every Sunday at the end, the pastor would just simply invite you to come forward and kneel. They called it the altar. It was really just in front of the pulpit or on the stairs or something like that. Kneel, and then if you want to do business with God or if you want to get something right with God, you can pray here. I don't begrudge anybody for doing that. If you want to pray at the front of the church, you can. Just wait till the service is done for us. But you ever wonder why it's called an altar? There have been songs that have been written, and like, is your all on the altar of sacrifice laid? And the idea behind the song is that you give yourself to God, and it's a metaphorical altar. But that's not where the altar comes from in the word altar call. The word altar in altar call comes from a medieval concept that arose within the church, and that was this. That every time you gathered, okay, when you go to a Catholic church to this very day, this is a practice that developed in the Middle Ages, in the center you have a table, and where the priest speaks from is off to the side. And where the Bible is read from is to the other side. I don't remember it's that side or that side, but they're off to the side. The center where the table is called the altar. Why is it called the altar? Because in the concept of transubstantiation, the table here and the Catholic idea of doing communion, having the elements of the bread and the wine, in the Catholic concept, every single time you do Mass, you re-sacrifice Christ. And his sacrifice is done daily. In direct contradiction to what this passage literally says. Jesus died, bang, his body was broken once for all time. There is nothing that needs to continue because Jesus fulfilled everything. Jesus fulfilled the sacrifice that no one else could fulfill. He did it once for all. And notice, folks, at the end of verse 27, what is the sacrifice that our high priest Jesus brings before the altar once for all? Once for all, when he offered up himself. Every sacrifice that ever pointed forward to the forgiveness of sin, all fulfilled in one sacrifice at one point, at one time, for all time. Jesus did it. He fulfilled it. It's done. So not only does Jesus fit, but Jesus fulfills. Then verse 28, Jesus finished. Jesus finished. Read verse 28 with me. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. Notice in this verse, it says that the weak law appointed weak priests. The law just simply was not able to do certain things. It appointed these weak priests who themselves were sinners, who themselves had an evil inclination, who themselves sinned. But Jesus' appointment was an appointment made with an oath. You remember the oath of Psalm 110. It says it was made with an oath, appointed by an oath from the Father, and it brings God's plan to consummation. Remember, we talked about that word perfect. That Jesus here is perfected forever. It's the Son. He appoints a Son who has been perfected or made perfect forever. The idea here isn't that Jesus was lacking somehow. The idea here is that Jesus finished, accomplished, ended what he set out to do. That's the idea of his perfection. He did it. He finished it. There is nothing left to be done. Now please remember that. Please keep that in mind every time your evil inclination drags you to sin or tempts you to sin and you succumb and you think, oh, that's it. I'm not right with God anymore. No, if you're a follower of Christ, his sacrifice did it all and was finished. What did Jesus himself declare on the cross? It is what? It's finished. It's done. There's nothing left to do. An old eccentric evangelist, as the story was told, itinerant evangelist used to go around putting up tents, having tent revival meetings. There was an old eccentric evangelist, as the story was told, was helping take down his tent, and a young man came up to him and said, "Preacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" As the story is told, the evangelist looked up from the peg he was trying to dislodge from the ground and kind of evaluated the situation, and he looked at the young man and he said, in a very stern and forceful voice, "Too late." The young man's eyes grew wide. His voice grew desperate. He said, "You mean there's nothing I can do? It can't be the end just because the revival meetings are done." The evangelist finally dislodged the tent peg that he was pulling from the ground and he says, "No, you're not getting me, son. You're too late. What needed to be done was done hundreds of years ago." We could say now, because the story is an old story, it was done thousands of years ago. You're too late. You can't do anything. Jesus did it. I cannot help but to hear that story and be reminded of the song we sang. Lord, now indeed I find thy power, and thine alone can change the leper's spots and melt the heart of stone. Jesus paid it all. Jesus paid it all. All to him I owe. Sin had left a crimson stain. He washed it white as snow. Jesus paid it all. I think the beauty of these concluding verses to chapter 7 of Hebrews is that the whole time, folks, the writer of Hebrews, the preacher, whoever he is, has been arguing that Jesus is better. He's better, he's better, he's better, he's better. And when he comes down to his final conclusion to really nail the point home, he doesn't simply say he's better. He simply concludes by saying he's everything. There is nothing else. The priesthood is weak. The law is weak. All we have is Jesus. He did it all. Let's pray.